Today is October 9th, the year 2000. I'm Jeff Charnley, interviewing Dr. Gladys Beckwith for the MSU Oral History Project for the Sesquicentennial to be commemorated 5 years from now in the year 2005. Dr. Beckwith, you can see that we're tape recording today. Do you give us permission to record this interview?
Oh, yes, I do.
I'd like to start first with some questions about your educational and professional background. Where did you go to school, and where did you ultimately end up at college? Where were you raised to start with? Where were you born and raised?
Okay. Well, I was born in Flint, Michigan. So, of course, I graduated from Flint Central. And then I went to what then was Flint Junior College. That no longer exists. It's turned into C.S. Mott Community College. But it was Flint Junior College then. And then I came to Michigan State. And I got my bachelor's degree here in English. I graduated in 1951. When I got my master's degree, and eventually a PhD from Michigan State. So I'm a true Michigan State product.
Your perspective as a student, what was the campus like when you came as an undergraduate?
Well, you know, I was thinking about that just today while I was teaching my students over there in Erickson Hall. Of course, it was much smaller. Mm-hmm. You know, it ended pretty much at the river. Mm-hmm. There wasn't much on South Campus. Erickson Hall didn't exist.
So the southern boundary was the Red Sea.
Well, there were some things over there, but I've forgotten really what was there because I didn't get over there very much. Mm-hmm. But the library is now the museum, and there was a library annex that stood where the new library is. But this was this side of the campus. What? This side of the river.
Yeah, north side of the river.
North side of the river, right. What was really, really the campus. Mm-hmm. Of course, this side hasn't changed so much. Well, I guess it has, but fortunately we've been able to preserve the area around Beaumont Tower. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Where was the English department at that
time?
Oh,
it was
right where it is.
Now, some things don't change over time. In Morrill Hall.
In Morrill Hall,
that's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Were you intending to teach high school, or was it when you began as an undergrad?
When I began as an undergrad, yes, I think I was. That was the intent of most young women who were in English at that time, that they would go ahead and teach high school, which I did for a while. Mm-hmm.
Where did you teach?
Well, I taught, where did I begin? I taught for half a year in Ionia, and then I taught, well, my husband was a student here. He was getting his master's degree. I taught in Sunfield, a little community outside of Grand Ledge. Then I taught, he and I taught together in Brighton. Then I taught in Athens, Ohio when he was on the faculty at Ohio University, and then 4 years in Old Town, Maine. So I had about 12 years. Mm-hmm. I was a student of high school.
What was his field?
He was in communications.
Uh-huh. And what was his name?
Gerald.
Mm-hmm. So when did you ultimately come back to MSU?
Well, I came back sort of as he was pursuing his graduate work as a part-time student, summers, whatever, mm-hmm. getting my master's. You know, I can't even remember the exact date I got mm-hmm. my master's degree, mm-hmm. but through the early 50s there. Summers, and I would take some night classes. I took some classes at the University of Michigan through their extension program. Mm-hmm. So I put it all together. In fact, I didn't really even realize I completed a master's. So I was reading the requirements one day, and I thought, I believe I've got enough great credits here for a master's degree. Added them all up. I surely did have. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Your master's and PhD, was that in English?
My master's degree was in English.
Okay.
Yeah. My PhD was in education with a minor in English.
After your experience in the high school, what did you do in your grad work here at the university? Did you specialize in any particular area?
Yes, I did. Originally, I was planning to go out and work in some field in education. I specialized in curriculum work, yeah, mm-hmm. and in the teaching of English.
What was it about curriculum work that appealed to you?
Curriculum development. Well, of course, see, I had all this public school experience, mm-hmm. so that was just a particular slot that was available that accommodated some of the interests that I had, and related to teacher education, the two went together. Mm-hmm. And I did a good deal of work in the behavioral sciences as part of it, sociology and psychology.
Mm-hmm. Who were some of your, who was your major professor?
Elizabeth Rusk.
Okay.
I don't know, have you heard her name?
No.
Well, she headed the developmental English program. That was housed over in the old Quonsets. You probably don't remember those.
I remember some of the Quonset. WKAR was in there,
yeah,
and people have talked about the Quonsets as mostly as living quarters, not so much as classrooms.
Well, they were converted to classrooms, yeah. Mm-hmm. The developmental English program was there. That was it was a remedial program. There isn't any other way to... That's what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And there were also some of the ATL courses that were taught over there, too. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think all of them were for a while until they got Bessie Hall built.
Mm-hmm.
And she headed that. And I taught there as a grad assistant.
Okay. In the developmental English?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I taught one semester there in ATL
as
a grad assistant, too.
At what point did you begin teaching for ATL?
Officially, I began the tenure stream in 1967. That's when I began teaching. I never taught outside the tenure stream in ATL.
Uh-huh.
I did teach some courses in the College of Education, courses in gender, during the summers there,
uh-huh.
graduate course, actually.
That was a field you were interested in the scholarly area, besides curriculum?
Oh, yes.
Gender studies?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. Very much so.
What do you think?
That was just beginning. I mean,
it was
that,
just starting?
Yes, it really didn't exist as a field yet. Which just courses beginning to be taught in that.
Besides yourself, were there any others that were on campus that were active
well,
in that
Well, one
study?
Other member of my committee, Louise Soss, she developed the course and she taught it during the year, but she didn't want to teach in the summer, so I taught it a couple of summers.
What was her last name?
Soss, S-A-U-S-E.
Okay.
And when she left, that course left with her. It was never taught again.
Uh-huh.
Which is too bad, but that does happen.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to happen to our men in America,
mm-hmm.
I think.
That track.
Mm-hmm. That's an aside. Whether it belongs in this interview or not, you can exit out if it doesn't.
Well, no, certainly not.
Yeah.
It sure does.
Yeah. But it does happen. When a professor who develops a course leaves, oftentimes it will disappear with that person.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I deal with it always.
How would you describe your work in the early stages here in ATL? Did you start full time or?
Oh yes.
Yep.
Okay. Yes.
In the tenure system, who was chair of that? Do you remember?
Vern Engel.
Vern Engel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And was that when the department had a dual mission in writing and speaking, or had they shifted?
No,
actually
they'd
to
already
the,
switched to ATL.
Okay.
Right,
so concentrating
on
writing.
Yeah, yep. It switched out of comm skills.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Anything about those early years that you're in early in your career? You started as assistant professor?
I was hired in the summer as an instructor because I didn't officially have the degree. But then I did complete it, I think it was in August, and so I was immediately promoted to assistant professor.
I see. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
Were you able to continue with that, or what were you, would you say was your scholarly interest besides teaching? I know teaching, you had probably a heavy load at that time. Did you have any research interests that were?
Well, you see, I was in a peculiar position because my research interests were very different from the interests of this department.
Mm-hmm.
The dissertation I'd done was a dissertation that dealt with the English teacher role. Most of it was done in sociology. Whereas this was a literary, historical department with the writing emphasis. Though I think at the time I came, there was more emphasis on the literary and the historical in a way than there was on the writing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's shifted over time, I think, mm-hmm. as the rhetoric has come back into more play across the country.
Mm-hmm.
So when I came, my research interests for a while were just really preparing to teach this course again,
mm-hmm.
because I hadn't done that kind of work, though I had the background and so forth. Then I helped worked on the development of some of the tracks that we began to offer, particularly the film track. That was the first one. And then as the women's studies movement began, of course, the development of the women's studies track. That began in the very early 70s. Okay. Yes, it did begin in the early 70s, it did. Along with some of the other people in the department.
Who were some of those that assisted or that you worked with in developing the women's studies track?
Well, Al Carson was one. He was a person who was interested in women's studies. Did you know him at all?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, well, he's dead now, but he was interested in women's studies and contributed a good deal. Joyce Ladenson, certainly from the very beginning. Pat Dietrich was, I think, the very first kind of informal coordinator of what became the Women's Studies program. Who else? In those early days, Sandy Gustafson, who was here as an instructor. I don't think Jocelyn ever taught women's studies. I'm not sure. She may have, but if she did, it wasn't for long. Those are the names I recall right now.
Mm-hmm.
I think Bruce Curtis, too, got involved at a relatively early point here.
Okay. In the early 1970s.
Yeah, about 1970, 71, 72.
In the development, you were one of the leaders, of course, in the development of the Michigan Women's Studies Association.
Mm-hmm.
Would you talk a little bit about how that came about? And
well, that was organized by that same core group of faculty initially right here, when we thought it would be a good thing to have a kind of state organization to give some support to other programs. So it wasn't easy to begin a women's studies program. Did you know that?
What were the problems that you faced?
Well, universities not anywhere did not greet this with open arms. They did not. I mean, it was a whole process there coming out of the 60s of opening the curriculum. And of course, if you open the curriculum, you necessarily are perceived as a threat to more established disciplines. We were constantly accused of being touchy-feely people, not a legitimate study, whatever. And as the resources tighten, too, there's a threat that you'll drain resources off other people. So I think we had less trouble on this campus than some other schools did. Grand Valley, they had a program that started before we did, but they dissolved a whole college over there. William James?
Mm-hmm.
And that effectively got rid of their women's studies program because all the faculty were gone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think this way. But we had tenured faculty from the start, and some didn't, as I say. Some had non-tenured. Well, if they didn't get tenure, clearly your program went. Some places just didn't get much financial support at all, but we did get more here.
Mm-hmm.
So,
was there opposition on the board to establish or to the establishment, or was there support? Or
I don't think there was much one way or the other. There was an open opposition.
Mm-hmm.
Way back there, as far as establishing the program.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always been a problem of obtaining financial support.
Mm-hmm. We're experiencing that
even today.
Uh-huh.
Well, for example, I was coordinator for 2-3 years, and we were housed over in the basement of Linton Hall. That was when we had the thematic program. So Michigan State doesn't have a minor, except in education. They have a minor in education. But other fields don't. You knew that.
Mm-hmm.
So we had what was called a thematic program. I don't know if those even exist any longer. They got rid of the thematic program in women's studies when women's studies became a major. But that was one of the big struggles of the time that I was coordinator, and we did get approval of the thematic program during that time. But another constant struggle was to get out of the basement. Have you ever seen the basement? Have you ever seen the basement of Linton Hall?
I was a TA there in the history department.
Well, then you know what the basement of Linton Hall was like. Mm-hmm. One day we came, the secretary and I, and they had cleared the snow and down there from their parking lot. And in doing that, the snow removal people had smashed the window. And the whole desk area was covered with the snow that they'd pushed in.
Mm-hmm.
And we had down there as our conference room, a room that had some broken down chairs. That was literally, they were broken.
Mm-hmm.
And that was our conference facility. So that was a big struggle there to get out of there. And we did get out of there. Joyce, when I left, she became the next coordinator. They moved her than the program upstairs into that suite, which is a very desirable suite. And the, was it the third floor of Linton Hall? I guess they've got to move again, but that is very desirable, very, very attractive, mm-hmm. and nicely furnished. So that was a major struggle to get out of there. Mm-hmm. One thing that I think could have been kind of a positive for us in this sense, I don't know if any of your people have talked about the faculty associates and the move to unionize the faculty.
No, but let's talk about that.
Yeah, you really ought to have something of that, because faculty associates, when it existed here, never succeeded. And I was president for a while, as well as some other people like Phil Korth and Mary Tompkins, who died not too long ago, never succeeded in organizing the campus. It was backed by MEA. We were an MEA affiliate. But I think it did have a very positive force in being able to surface some issues. And we had also time, early 70s there, we brought a sex discrimination suit against the university with several named plaintiffs. All of this was going on at the same time that the Women's Studies program was getting started. And although I can't say that there was a linkage between the two, I do believe administrations tend to be a little more charitable when a lawsuit is pending.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You were involved in that lawsuit?
I wasn't a named plaintiff, mm-hmm. no. But Pat Dietrich, as I recall, was for a while, but then she withdrew. Dorothy McNeekin in the College of Natural Science was. Mm-hmm. It settled eventually. That was how that was resolved. Mm-hmm. And it resulted in a substantial settlement for the plaintiffs who remained on that. Mm-hmm. And then I think also some closer scrutiny of the salaries of women faculty.
Was it equal pay for,
yes, that was what the issue was, pay, and it was pretty well established that the salaries of women were not commensurate with the salaries of men faculty. And so, then, of course, out of that came cohort analysis, you know, so that was devised as a means of trying to assure at least that sex didn't enter, or gender didn't enter as a variable. Uh-huh. But that was a long struggle to get to that.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Some of the other issues about the faculty associates, who else was involved in that leadership? You mentioned a couple.
Bruce Curtis was, mm-hmm. yeah.
So some ATL faculty
ATL faculty were. This was perceived as a hotbed of resistance here, mm-hmm. yeah, or activism. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say resistance, activism, yeah. Mm-hmm. Reed Baird, who of course, died not too long ago also, yeah. Mm-hmm. But the leadership came out of here, see, three of us, Mary Tompkins, Bruce, and myself.
The unionization issue obviously is an important one, and at that time, the activism that resulted, how did the administration react to, this would have been, let's see, how did the administration react to attempts at unionization?
Well, I don't think the administration wanted a union. AAUP was also involved, but after that last election, we never heard very, when faculty associates was decisively defeated. Mm-hmm. AAUP, not so. I don't think that was taken as a put down of unionization so much as it was a put down of unionization by MEA. Many faculty didn't want anything to do with MEA, frankly, because it was classroom teachers, they thought. Mm-hmm. And as you may know, many universities feel that's a, many professors feel that's a real put down. Did you know that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But AAUP gained, as I recall, and I'm not certain of this, but I think they picked up substantially. It may have been if they had persevered with their efforts that they might have organized the faculty, mm-hmm. Particularly considering some of the things that have happened since, things like post-tenure review. Mm-hmm. You know, AAUP is fighting that tooth and nail mm-hmm. at Wayne State University. Well, there is no force left on this campus now to fight anything tooth and nail.
Mm-hmm. When was the last attempt to unionize the faculty, at least formal through a vote, or do you remember that?
Well, that was when Phil Korth was president. You know, I don't remember the exact dates of that. I could get those, mm-hmm. but I don't recall
okay.
right
well,
now.
Well.
It was under
Dr. Horton?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
No, it was more recent than that. It was in the last 10 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Going back to some of the issues that you raised about the Michigan Women's Studies Association. What were some of the activities that you were involved in as an organization?
Well, initially, of course, we had a large number of other institutions that belonged. We don't have so many now because then there was more of a need, as I say, for institutions to come together. Many now have established programs. They don't particularly need an organization or else they have a place within the professional organizations where they can present papers, whatever. But we have the newsletter. We still do have a newsletter. And we had the annual conference, and those I get. We also did a study. We did a study of women's studies programs in the public, not public schools, but in the community colleges and in four-year institutions. We had some grant funding for that, and that took one of our members at Saginaw Valley did a large part of the work on that. And we really need to do that again and see what changes have come about. Mm-hmm. One that's come about, I know, just from the little informal studies that we've done, is that women's studies has virtually disappeared from the community college.
From community college. Yeah. Sure. And initially it was a strong...
Some of the first questions were from there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it went the way of having centers, resource centers and so forth, which are good, and counseling returning women and so forth. But women's studies virtually phased right out. But I talked to person down at Henry Ford just last week. They had one of the first programs. Their program has just been eliminated.
Hmm. But how would you assess the programs at the four-year schools? Do most of the four-year schools in the state have
those? Well, most four-year schools do have them, yes, okay. They do. And they are developing in the private schools, mm-hmm. in the private four-year schools. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We are having our annual conference this year at Marygrove.
There you go, okay.
Yeah, which is, you know, is a private Catholic school. And they don't have a women's studies program, but they are offering some women's studies courses, and their president is very enthusiastic about us having this conference down there because it is fitting right into what they're trying to do, which is to empower women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is Paula Stouffer involved in that? Or
no.
I'm not sure. Okay.
No, yeah. I know.
Didn't know that.
Who?
Paula Stouffer?
Paula Stouffer.
I thought she taught down there, but
she
I might be mistaken.
She may. That's a name that's very familiar to me.
I think she did a study of Michigan midwifery, I think.
Did she? Yeah, because mm-hmm. we had an exhibit on midwifery.
Mm-hmm.
That name is just very familiar to me.
I know, she had done some oral histories, too.
Yeah, has she? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Could be that she's still there.
So the conference is a key element of mm-hmm. the of the organization?
Was, and we still do that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's an annual conference?
Annual conference, okay. Yeah. And it's a way, of course, of disseminating research, but increasingly it has become a way that students, graduate students, and sometimes undergraduates, can present their research and gain some experience of doing that and maybe credential themselves a bit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How would you assess the quality of the papers or the range of research?
I think it's good, yeah, mm-hmm. it is, yeah. Of course, it's been helped a lot, too, by the Internet now, mm-hmm. because we can get the word out. Mm-hmm. And so we bring people. People have come from other states.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they did last year, as far as Philadelphia.
Is the focus on Michigan women especially, or is it just basically a conference of Michigan women?
Well, we started having it be on Michigan women, Michigan history, excuse me, but then we broadened it somewhat. So there may be some sessions. We offer that as an option.
Mm-hmm.
But no, last year the conference was on New Directions for the Millennium.
Mm-hmm.
And this year they chose their own conference, their own theme down at Marygrove. And what they want to focus on is preparing women to live in a global society.
Mm-hmm. So there has been a change in focus,
for the conference, yeah. Mm-hmm. But, now in the whole historical center and so forth, we are still focusing on Michigan women, and that's our major project now.
Mm-hmm. Would you talk a little bit about the development of the Michigan Women's Historical Center and Hall of Fame? How were you involved in that?
Well, we undertook that. That's the project of the Michigan Women's Studies Association when we... See, the philosophy of, it goes back to the philosophy of women's studies early on in the 70s. Women's studies began philosophically. It hoped to bridge the gap between the academy and the community. So there would be cross-fertilization. Time went on. It sort of became clear not a whole lot of that was going to happen. Maybe less. because his programs became more established in the academic world, they tended to follow the traditional path. They had to. That is, the professors teaching women's studies and so forth had to credential themselves in the same fashion, research and publication, etc. There wasn't much room left there for community activism or participation in what's going on out here. Does that make sense to you?
Sure.
Okay, so that's sort of different from what our philosophy was. Mm-hmm. So what we wanted to do was develop a kind of facility where you could do community-based education, where we could make use of the research which we had, but make it available not just to the campus where there's a surfeit and a plethora of research made available, really, mm-hmm. but out in the community where there's not so much and where perhaps people could take advantage of this and where we could be of some use in that way. So we devised that idea of a center, and at the same time we had that idea of a center, lo and behold, here's this fine piece of property, the Cooley Hayes House, which the city of Lansing is about to tear down. So we were able, over a period of about 3 or 4 years, to negotiate a long-term lease with them. We had some little short-term leases, but we got a long-term lease on that property. But we had to renovate it and bring it up to code. And that's what we did. We raised the money to do that and then opened there in 1987. But increasingly, a major project of that and of the Michigan Women's Studies Association, really, has been the carrying out of the Hall of Fame selection process, which is a huge task. Mm-hmm. And that has uncovered, I think, a good deal of Michigan history. We've sort of rediscovered women, or maybe discovered women who we've not known about, and we're mm-hmm. doing that all the time. And then, of course, those women are recognized in the Hall of Fame induction dinner that we're getting ready to do again 2 weeks from this coming Thursday.
How does that process work?
Well,
thumbnail.
Terrible. Mm. No, it isn't. But it is very time consuming. That is, we receive nominations for this year round. But our big time when we really promote the sending your nomination, please, is January to March of each year. So each year we probably have about 100 nominations. They're not all new. Some of them are resubmitted from other years. But when we close the nominations for that year, in March, we generally have about 100. And they're divided between the contemporary and the historic. Then we have a total of 4 panels, 2 for the contemporary, 2 for the historic. So we send all these forms out to the initial nominating panel. They get about 100 forms to read and to screen. And there are probably at that stage about 10, 12 people on each panel. And they read them independently. They don't meet in any kind of meeting. They read and rank them on a ballot, send them back, and we send them out to Maynard Coast Garrison and Ellis, the accounting firm, who counts them and tabulates them. And then we take the top 20. Sometimes 21, 22 if there's a tie. And we send them on to the final panel of judges who go through exactly the same procedure. And then the board does meet and we will induct no more than 10. And the only role the board plays is deciding how many we will take and the distribution of that 10 or 8. Will it be more historic, more contemporary, what? Then they are inducted into the Hall of Fame, as I say, at the dinner, which occurs every October. Then we have exhibits, pictures, information about them at the center. We too are about, as I guess I told you not too long ago, about to embark on a videotaping project of the contemporary honorees so that we can preserve their memories and perceptions too for future generations. And then we also maintain an archive and build up what information we can about them. Some of them have placed their papers with us. More would like to, but we don't have a lot of space. So if there are any kinds of collections over at the Bentley or the Burton or whatever, we try to shift the papers to another place where there is a little bit more space.
Where they can maintain.
That's right. But it is a very good, it's a very good way here. We've got a good little collection of Michigan women's history building there. Some of it built. We've done some publication. Mm-hmm. We have our book, Historic Women of Michigan, a collection of essays, and Betty McDowell and Rachel Brett Harley have done Michigan Women First and Founders, Volume 1 and 2. Betty's currently revising Volume 1, which has identified Michigan women who have done things or founded things for the first time. Mm-hmm. And that's a really good reference, too.
Mm-hmm. Have you found a lot of demand for that
book?
Yes,
we have. Yeah. Yes, we have, for all of them. Yeah, in fact, we're sold out of the first edition of First and Founders, Volume 1. That's why we're revising it. Mm-hmm. And the Historic Women of Michigan, we are reordering, and this is its third edition, third printing. Yeah, and it came out in 1987.
Mm-hmm. When have you had much contact with the National Women's Hall of Fame, Seneca Falls, or has your development?